I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
I'm Ken Nash.
We're Building Bridges. Chuck Collins joins us to discuss Altar to an Erupting Sun, his provocative new book, dangerous in the way it makes us think hard about what we might need to do to save Earth's biosphere from a mass extinction event. Chuck Collins has devoted the bulk of his professional life to researching, writing about, and organizing around income inequality and the growing wealth divide in our country. But now he's tackling another component of the issue. Chuck Collins, thank you for joining us. And I want to know about how you would characterize the wealth disparity in this particular period of the robber barons and the worship, if you will, of the golden calf, and the consequences for society in conjunction with the issue of your new fiction work, which tells it like it is, and that is Altar to an Erupting Sun, a look at climate devastation.
It's great to be with you. And I would characterize us that we're kind of in a period of hyper-extreme inequality that even accelerated during the pandemic, the concentration of wealth flowing upwards into the hands, not of just the 1% or even the top 0.1%, but the ultra wealthy is extraordinary. We haven't seen anything in our lifetimes, and certainly not in the last century. And I think it has huge implications for everything, obviously for democracy and the economy and the health of everybody. But it's part of what locks us into this collision course in terms of the environment as well, that the concentrated power of the fossil fuel industry, which is a very powerful, active subset of the ultra rich, they have locked us onto this trajectory, taking us over a cliff. You know, we can't now separate this concentration of wealth from the ecological challenges that our societies and planet is facing. They're really interconnected.
From income inequality and the growing wealth divide, as you're focusing on and honing your research tools and interests on the climate crisis, what is that inherent link that you just alluded to? How is it evident between your work on wealth disparity and the climate crisis by virtue of the plutocrats' drive for profits? How does that materialize?
It's very much in the form of it's the power that comes with wealth, the power to kind of shape the politics and policy. So, you know, we now know that Exxon and Shell knew 40, 50 years ago about the harmful effects, that a couple dozen corporations and their leaders and their financial enablers have funded climate denial. They've sowed doubt. They've funded the most retrograde politicians, not just in terms of climate, but on other issues as well. They have stalled and blocked alternatives to a transition to a healthier energy system. They've used their considerable power to run out the clock, to limit our options. That's one manifestation. And the other is how they control the media, control the story, control the narrative. So what we're living with today, rising smoke flowing into our cities from Canadian forest fires, heat waves, we're on the precipice and certain parts of the planet are obviously experiencing even greater distress. We're basically going to see a disrupted future. The fossil fuel industry, again, would like us to think, well, it's all of our responsibility. It's the fact that you took a car to the store and didn't walk or bicycle. You know, it's your carbon footprint. They would like us to all believe we are all responsible for the climate crisis. We're like the users and they're just the providers. But in fact, they have constrained and locked us into this course. You know, it's true. We all can do things. We all are responsible, particularly those of us in the United States, you know, middle-class, affluent households. We have a disproportionate responsibility, but it's this powerful, profitable industry that has really shaped the menu of what we have to work with.
Recently, the Senate Budget Committee held a hearing to scrutinize the role of oil and gas-linked dark money in delaying climate action, really tearing through local and federal budgets. I wonder what your thoughts are about what came out of it, or was it, how constructive it was, this hearing that was held by Senator Shelton Whitehouse of Rhode Island on dark money influencing the development and expansion of the fossil fuel sector.
Well, it was a very important hearing, and it kind of picked up the work that Carolyn Maloney was doing in the House when she was chairing the Government Oversight Committee when the Democrats were in power in the House 2 years ago. She did a series of hearings on the role of the fossil fuel industry. When did they know? What did they know? How did they use their power? And, of course, the Democrats lost control of the House, and all of those research and reports that the Government Oversight Committee did were deleted from the website. So it's great that Senator Whitehouse on the Senate side is picking up and looking at how the fossil fuel industry uses its dark money to back channel climate denial, sham science, getting money to politicians. And the context is the oil. It's not just like the Koch brothers. They're the most obvious from the energy industry, but really since the 1920s and the 1930s, the Texas oil and now gas interests are some of the biggest funders of kind of right-wing politics in this country. And that's what this dark money is showing, that the money is going, that they're willing to destroy our democracy to keep their profits and keep the fossil fuel industry flush. Even if it means the destruction of a habitable earth. So wow. It was really important that Senator Whitehouse really was kind of looking at the mechanisms that these oil, gas, and coal companies use to shape and warp our political system.
Save our planet, SOS. This really is, and you've just given us a prelude to our really substantive discussion of Altar to an Erupting Sun, your latest book. And to probe it in earnest, why don't we begin our sojourn with your reading a passage from Altar to an Erupting Sun, and we will continue to look then at SOS, Save Our Planet.
Thank you for that invitation. And, a little snippet from the book, let me just set the context. It's the first time I've written fiction, and it was an opportunity to talk about and envision, part of the novel looks ahead 7 years, and it's not, a zombie apocalypse, it's not Blade Runner, it's how do our communities start to turn the corner and come together and make a difference. And it's not a spoiler alert to say that my main character, a woman named Ray Kelleher, lifelong activist, and part of what I wanted to do in this novel is celebrate, well, people like you, people like many of your listeners who've spent, decades working on economic and environmental justice issues. And some of those movements are lifted up and celebrated in this. But let me just share a little bit of a flavor about Ray Kelleher. And it's not a spoiler alert to say that, the book begins with her engaging in a pretty shocking action. She's a lifelong, nonviolent direct action activist, but at the end of her life, she's facing down a diagnosis of a terminal illness. She only has a month or two to live. She decides to exit, end her life, and take the life of a CEO of a fossil fuel industry. So she engages in what is considered a shocking act of eco-terrorism by the larger media. So that's how the book starts.
It certainly does.
Intentionally provocative. But and then the book is really sort of like, well, why did she do that? What shaped her? What was her understanding of the moment that we're in now? And it also projects out 7 years to show the impact of her actions. And both the blowback, the tremendous negative blowback, but also the fact that the society really starts to turn the corner and starts to look at the role of the fossil fuel industry. And so let me just share, toward the end of her life, she is reading intensely. She's part of a pipeline fight, like many people have been you know, kind of going out and saying no new fossil fuel infrastructure. She's really trying to push back on you know, new construction of fossil fuel pipelines. And she's part of an effort in her community to resist that. But then she's, you know, learning more and more. She gets thrown out of a meeting of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, and things like that. So she starts to see the power of the fossil fuel industry. And so I'm going to just read a little snippet. She's with her husband, Reggie, and they've kind of gone on a bicycle trip, reenacting sort of an important trip in their own life. And they are at a bookstore in Montague, Massachusetts, which is a town in western Massachusetts. And she can't, she's doing one of these, she's reading from The Guardian, reading about the dangers of climate change, and she's talking to her husband.
And we're speaking while he finds this section with Chuck Collins about his new fiction book, which is Larger Than Life, which is life, which is an interesting compilation of experiences that seek to deal with, and we'll discuss how more when when Chuck finds the passage to read, how to deal with the climate crisis. Are we set, Great. Chuck?
Yes. So this is Ray Kelleher, the main character, and Reggie Donaher, her husband. And he works in this space. Let me just, in the previous week, Ray and Reggie had watched a three-part frontline documentary, The Power of Big Oil. And now she pulls out her Guardian Weekly with a special investigation on carbon bombs, which she actively reads, pen in hand. Reggie joins Ray at the table. He puts down his three book purchases and a glass of hard cider on the table. Basically, these oil and gas companies are betting against humanity. Ray waves a fork in the air. They are incapable of stopping themselves. She points at what she's reading and says to Reggie, okay, so you have the Secretary General of the United Nations saying that if we don't cut off fossil fuel use, we will miss our chance to secure a livable and sustainable future. And you've got big oil and gas investing in 195 projects that will each release at least a billion tons of CO2 emissions, what they call carbon bombs. Reggie knows this picture, but the new data is stunning. Wow, he says. Our job is to make sure those become stranded assets, that their carbon holdings remain in the ground, and that all the infrastructure and equipment becomes useless. What a waste. Ray doesn't say anything more in response to Ray's provocation. He's watching with concern as she has become more impatient and righteous and sometimes even hurtful to the people she loves. She recently stood up at a local talk about beavers and criticized the analytical shortcomings of a young speaker. She's been yelling on the phone and hanging up on her brother Toby and using the F word more frequently and more. Reggie focuses on Ray, watching her as well as listening. She's more agitated than passionate. He swears he sees a flicker of fear in her eyes, not her usual slow burn fire. Or is it the rage that he is unaccustomed to? You are with someone for 36 years, he thinks, but there is still some uncharted territory in there. Ray notices his look. They exchange a silent glance. You think I've gone off the deep end, she says. It just looks like your celebrated cold fission anger is hot and heading toward a meltdown zone. Yeah, you may be right about that. Ray pauses before making a confession. I feel something off kilter in my body, in my gut. And that's a prelude to her realizing that she is not healthy and not going to live much longer. And so that's just a window into Ray, who is usually, in most cases, the life of the party and the celebrator of...
We're talking with Chuck Collins, who was just doing a brief reading from his very important book, which is a work of fiction, which I'm interested in why you chose to use a fiction. You, a hardcore, aggressive, economic-based researcher who looks at wealth inequality. What were you freeing yourself from the rigors of reporting in accordance with the statistical data, etc.? Why did you choose to use fiction as a way of telling this a critical story about the increasing devastation of the climate?
Well, part of it was that the power of storytelling, and in this case, trying to offer a vision of, you know, the next 7 years that draws on some of the best organizing and things that are happening in the climate disruption space, in terms of, and also in terms of like how communities can prepare for a disrupted future. So that was part of it. It is liberating to not have to keep track of footnotes and things like that. But more important, I hope it's a story that, that is a good story. You know, I think the other reason was I wanted to explore sort of the tactics that, that movements need to think about right now. And so, and it was fun to do that through fiction, even though I'm drawing on real historical examples. So I talk a lot about bold direct action, movements that include property destruction, people who have made dramatic witnesses like self-immolation, like the Buddhist monks in Vietnam. I wanted to have a way in a fictional space to explore what the escalation of tactics is going to look like in the coming years, which I think is clearly going to happen. We're going to see, you know, partly because our political system is completely incapable of responding right now to the level of the crisis. And so people are going to be both desperate but also strategic and thinking about how do we make a difference right now? Where are the pressure points? Where can we shift the trajectory, if you will, of what the fossil fuel industry has done to us?
Well, you start the book with a real provocation. You start with a murder. And I want you to help in your, you know, make sense of how, or help us understand of what we are to glean from Ray's act. I mean, there's we know the government has rigorously, for much less things than the elimination of an oil baron, prosecuted groups like Earth First for resistance as eco-terrorists and so on. What are we to make of, what are you suggesting to us about tactical responses? Because this isn't a nihilistic book in its final analysis. It is a plea for action and certainly suggestive of such. But how are we to understand the issue of, to begin with, the elimination, the murder of a dangerous component individual who represents systemically, not just as an individual. And I think that's very important in the book, that there's a systemic critique of the destruction of the planet. So what do we do, and what are you saying about the elimination of this carbon baron to begin with?
One of the things I think the book tries to do, the story, is show how harmful that action is, that it has, you know, negative impact. It leads to repression. There's a criminalization of dissent. All these are things I think that would happen, as you point out, Mimi, even for lesser actions, government repression has stepped up. The fossil fuel industry will press to militarize and protect their facilities and their people. It's probably not strategically or morally effective. But what Ray's action does do is it kind of points this laser focus on these couple of dozen corporations and their leaders and their responsibility and culpability in this. And I think one of the things that Ray's daughter at the end of the book says, you know, Ray, what Ray did was wrong. But what she's saying is, what bold action will each of you take to defend Mother Earth? What does that look like? Where are the sort of pressure points? And, you know, if we really understand that the this little rogue fossil fuel industry has wielded their power for 50 years to block alternatives, that may inform our strategy. I think you would see more hearings like what Senator Whitehouse did. Let's look at the role of the fossil fuel industry. Let's criminalize some of those actions. Let's create public authorities to seize and the assets of these fossil fuel companies and wind them down so that they can't be extracted and burned. We should look at the ways in which government has been hijacked and captured by the fossil fuel industry, you know, all the oversight agencies that just do their bidding. But on an individual level, she's, you know, also exhorting each of us to do our own powerful, bold witness, to be part of this global climate justice movement in this moment. She thinks it's a Bonhoeffer moment. She reads the German pacifist theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was part of a failed attempt to assassinate Hitler. She believes it's a Bonhoeffer moment in the fight to save the Earth. But the other people around who are arguing for other tactics that also may and probably will be more effective. So I think that's part of the fun of the story, is let's have it out. Let's envision what this scenario might look like and think about the other pressure points and ways we can make a difference.
Goodness, I guess you're headed for the ban the book list.
It would be an honor to be on that, among that good company.
Well, we are talking about Altar to an Erupting Sun. And one of the things that I particularly was interested in the book is the experiences that you use that are experiences that are familiar to many activists. And one of the ones that hit me most strategically, really, was Ray was involved in, you know, travels to Central America, and she became a trainer and leader of the School of the Americas Watch. Now, I found that particularly interesting because I know your own Institute of Policy Studies lost two members, right, as a result of the School of the Americas violence, and annually actually represents the Latelier, that's Orlando Latelier, Ronnie Moffitt Human Rights Award in remembrance. They were Ronnie Moffitt was blown up by a car bomb in Washington. I want you to say a bit more about that kind of conjuncture of bringing together something that your agency actually works on, and how this informed and why you chose to use this to inform Ray as a character in her work to be driven to her act of desperation, some extent nihilism, but definitely an act to save the Earth. Where does that come into play?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the best sense, this is a formation story. It's a story of what shapes somebody, not just the individuals, but in the case of Ray Kelleher, the social movements. And, so she's part of the anti-nuclear power movement. She goes, like a lot of people in the 80s, went to Central America, picked coffee and cotton in Nicaragua, was part of international solidarity movements with the people of El Salvador. And then came back to the United States realizing, okay, we train the terrorists. We train the militaries that use interrogation techniques and torture their own people. So she really gets a kind of global understanding of the role of the U.S. and U.S. foreign policy and empire in Central America. And, you know, I was able to weave in the true story. You know, what we found out was that the School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia, was training, Pinochet, General Pinochet of Chile's terrorists, the people who did the the car bombing that killed my IPS colleague Orlando Letier in the streets of Washington, D.C. in 1976. And Ronnie Carp and Moffitt.
And I'm afraid I have to the tyranny of the clock is upon us. So you're going to have to find out more if you read the book. But it's all in there. It's all in there. Real experiences. And I just, in 30 seconds that we really have left, Chuck Collins, you want readers to be shocked, even repulsed by Ray's final act. But not only that, what else do you want readers to engage with in this story? And again, the book we're talking about is Altar to an Erupting Sun.
Just hope people will read the book and then sort of ask themselves, what am I called to do? What bold, risky action might I take in defense of the Earth? It's not what Ray did, but there are plenty of other bold actions. There are groups like Climate Defiance and Extinction Rebellion and people stepping up every day. There are people working to close down private jet airports and that sort of thing. I think we're just called to step it up, to really respond to the gravity of the problem.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but not before you pick up Altar to an Erupting Sun. The writing is scintillating, exciting, important, and real to us doing what? Responding to SOS, Save Our Planet. Chuck Collins, thank you for the work you do. The book is phenomenal reading. Listeners, pick up Chuck Collins' Altar to an Erupting Sun. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
I'm Ken Nash.
And we're Building Bridges.